Hello, welcome to Basic Folk, honest conversations with under-the-radar folk musicians. It's Cindy Howes. Oh man, my life is still really weird where I'm, like, still living in Pittsburgh, but, like, my house got sold, which is awesome. I'm, like, basically, like, in a weird place, you know, where I don't, like, live in Pittsburgh anymore, but I don't yet live in Boston. I got a place in Somerville, Massachusetts that I'm pretty excited about, and I'll start working at WERS in February as their marketing and promotions manager, which is, like, gonna be so fun. I'm looking forward to it a lot. Also looking forward to, like, being back in the fold, so to speak, in the Boston music community, which basically inspired me to start this podcast. It's such a rich scene of folk music, Americana, bluegrass, roots music, and one of the most exciting bands coming out of the Boston music scene these days is Lula Wiles. Their new album is What Will We Do? And today, on Basic Folk, we are going to be talking to member Eleanor Buckland from Lula Wiles. But before we get into exactly what she and I talk about, let's take a moment to thank our sponsors for Basic Folk. All right, Basic Folk receives support from Lindsay Myers at LMNO Management, who encourages listeners to check out the songwriting duo Mick Dean. You can download singles from their forthcoming EP by going to mickdean.co/basicfolk. All right, so we get into it here on Basic Folk with Eleanor Buckland, who is of the band Lula Wiles, like I was talking about. She and Issa Burke and Molly Obomsawin all come from rural Maine. So we talk about Eleanor's upbringing and learning music at an early age, being around music pretty consistently. Fiddle camp really paints a picture of what it's like to go to fiddle camp. She talks about her family quite a bit. Her brother suffered a traumatic brain injury, which really changed her and her family. And she got her to talk about that a bit and forming Lula Wiles and, you know, just making great tunes. So before we listen to our interview with Eleanor Buckland, we're going to hear a song from Lula Wiles' new album. Again, the record is called What Will We Do? Which, hey, pretty cool. The album was premiered on NPR First Listen, which is awesome for Lula Wiles. We're going to hear the song My Hometown, which is from the new album featuring Eleanor Buckland on leads. And then we'll get to our conversation with her on Basic Folk. Call you Ellie, or do you want me to call you Eleanor?
So this is, like, a great question. This is actually something that, like, you and I are friends, so I'm Ellie to my friends and to people who know me, and, like, the way that I am just as a person in the world, I'm definitely Ellie. But I made a conscious decision to have my professional name in music be Eleanor, because I wanted there to be a separation between just, like, me as a person and somebody who that you as my friend know intimately. I don't, but I want there to be some kind of, like, artistic separation. It's a pretty new change. Like, Issa and Molly on stage, they'll still be like, Eleanor Buckland on stage or whatever. But I think that the way I've thought about it is that, like, in any kind of intimate situation, that it's like I'm completely comfortable being called Ellie. And just, it's like in the liner notes of the new Lulu Wiles record, anytime I'm being introduced on stage, anytime I'm being written about or talked about. So I think, like, if there's any section of it where we're like, oh yeah, this is Eleanor Buckland's thing, or like Eleanor Buckland is in Lulu Wiles, but you and me talking during this podcast, like, just call me Ellie.
Yeah. Okay.
That's way easier. And that's how I want it, if that makes sense.
Where did your name come from?
I'm pretty sure my parents named me after Eleanor Roosevelt, and I know that they wanted to name their kids, and specifically their daughters. They had two daughters, like my sister Abigail and then me. They wanted to name us, like, pretty complex names, nothing that, like, something that felt really solid and, like, had some substance to the name.
Mm-hmm.
My middle name, Francis, one of my favorite things about my name is the fact that my middle name is Francis and that I have such an old-fashioned sounding name, Eleanor Francis Buckland. As a kid, I always really liked that. And Francis, I'm named after my dad's great-aunt. My great-aunt? My dad's aunt? I don't know. I'll have to, like, dad, don't fact-check this, but whatever. But anyway, she was a spy for the U.S. Navy. So, yes. And I think I'm allowed to say this now that, like, she's not alive. But
yeah,
she was my dad's aunt, and my mom, she was, like, my mom's favorite aunt on my dad's side. She, like, had cats and was really weird. And anyway, so I got named after her. But I don't use that. Nobody knows that except all of you listening now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you are a fourth generation musician.
Mm-hmm,
And people in the folk world know your parents?
Well, not my mom. My mom is not a musician, and she's a casual musician. She does community choir. It's very cute.
And this is awesome.
Farmington, Maine, where I grew up. I was born there and grew up there. But my dad is a professional musician, but I don't think, but he's played a ton of different styles of music his whole life. And so in the music community in Maine, like, in whether it's like blues and rock, or like, he just mostly played rock music forever. And then like when I was born, and I think he was getting into like folk and bluegrass styles when I was really little, that was something that like he was sort of going back in his musical roots, as my grandmother was a bluegrass musician. So he was sort of like getting into, you know, like learning more about that type of music. But for like his whole thing was rock and roll, you know. And so actually in Boston, he and my mom lived here in Boston during the 80s. My dad was playing all over town. It's like so interesting now living in Boston, figuring out how, like, who knew my dad, or like I'll meet people and realize that like they used to play in a band with like somebody that he used to play in a band with or something. And like, so a lot of my friends here in Boston who are like of my dad's generation, they're like, oh yeah, I remember Andy. Or like my dad would be like, oh yeah, I remember Dave Champagne, like he played in Treat Her Right and all. And so that's been really cool about living in Boston, is like learning about my dad's. And
how do you say your dad's last name?
Buckland.
Oh, I thought it was something else.
No.
What's his first name?
Andy.
Andy
or
Buckland.
Andrew.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever. Andy Buckland. Yeah.
Probably on stage goes by Andrew.
Yeah, he's always just played like electric guitar in a bunch of groups. Yeah.
And so music seemingly was everywhere for you when you were a kid and you had three siblings.
Yeah, I had three siblings. So on my dad's side, my aunts and uncles all would, like, get together and sing. And growing up when we'd have big get-togethers on my dad's side, there was a lot of, like, mostly just, like, jamming songs, right? Like, we would all just, like, sing songs together. And then, like, once I was playing fiddle, when I was, like, 5 or 6, I started playing fiddle. Mm-hmm. And so once I started playing fiddle, it was, like, I would jam along on the fiddle, but it was probably like hilariously not, you know, it would be like, oh, let's have Ellie like play a fiddle tune. And then we would like all go back to like singing other songs. You know, I wasn't really like soloing at age 6. It goes back on my dad's side of the family, that's the sort of fourth generation thing. So my grandmother, Betty Buckland, I never met her, but she was a bluegrass musician. She taught my dad guitar and taught all his siblings how to sing. And my dad's side of the family is quite large, and we're all like very loud and have a great time when we get together. We have this like lake house in the family that we would all converge on during the summer and spend like tons of nights playing music on the porch together. Those are some of my strongest and like my most fond memories of music during my childhood is with my family up at Lake George.
That's cool. Yeah. And your grandmother is from Appalachia?
No. So like her parents were, but she grew up in New York. And I'm a little fuzzy on the details of this, but you go back to, I think it's her dad. Her parents, one of them was also a performing musician. And so that's sort of where like the four generations comes from. Yeah, she played bluegrass banjo in the 60s and was like one of the only women at that time playing Scrugg style banjo. So that's like the three finger, it's like what you know of as right. Bluegrass, the bluegrass sound. But yeah, so she's sort of a personal legend and hero of mine and somebody that like, yeah, I really wish I could have met her.
Did you ever get to hear any of her performances?
Well, we don't have any recordings that I'm aware of her performing out. But I did find I was just Googling her the other day I was trying to meet somebody down in Nashville. It's unrelated to the story. Anyway, I was Googling her and I found in the Folk New England archives, like a scanned copy of some sort of like arts magazine or even just like, it wasn't a playbill, but it was sort of like a listing kind of, I think it was basically like a la Dig Boston before mm-hmm. Dig Boston
like
existed.
Like an alternative weekly.
Yeah, yes, newspaper. Or something like that. Yes. And in it, it has this like little thing where it's like Betty and the Moonlighters, and her name was Betty Buckland, and she had a band that she would like led the band. She was like lead singer and played banjo, and like it was her band called the Moonlighters because they all had other jobs and they were just like moonlighting as musicians. And I one day dream of at least playing some shows as Eleanor in the Moonlighters, just as homage to her, but the day has cool. yet to come. But so I haven't, so that was really cool to find that and like just like see it in print that they were performing at like two different coffee houses around in Massachusetts.
That's cool.
But then we do have recordings of parties that they used to have. Like it was just like this home tape recorder kind of situation that they would just like set up on the table. And my dad remembers this, that they would always have parties like in the basement and at his house. And so it's like set up and you can kind of, and they like, and some of them, it's just like going for the whole party. And then there are like a bunch of tunes and it's like people jamming. And it's a lot of like bluegrass greats and legends that were around New England at the time. Peter Rowan played with her for a short time when he was like 19. And the Osborne brothers were really good friends with Betty, my grandmother, and Larry, my grandfather, who's not a musician, but just was like down for the hang, I think.
Down to clown.
Yes, yeah. And so so some of these parties have like some of those folks, but also just like local musicians that were really into it. And so in these recordings, you can hear like them all just like chit-chatting and then they'll play a song. But then you can also hear like glasses clinking, like they're all like drinking and partying and then like also recording their jam sessions. So those are the recordings that we have, no performances.
I have a question about your brother.
So totally.
Talk about his brain injury.
Yeah.
So you told me about this a little bit, mm-hmm. and then it does come up in at least one of your songs. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me more about the injury and how that experience like creeps into your music beyond just like that one song that you mentioned in it?
Right. I think it was 5 years ago. It's always hard to keep track because I feel like it was so recently, and then I'll, you know, like, look at the calendar and realize, like, oh my God, it was 5 years ago. But yeah, so my brother suffered a traumatic brain injury while skateboarding, and it was without, like, sensationalizing it. It just was the most intense thing that had really ever happened to my family, at least, like, the six of us, the nuclear family, in terms of, like, emotional turmoil that we all went through. And it really affected us all so deeply. And, like, you know, I think also, like, most of all my brother. And that's something that, like, you know, it's like he's still recovering from it, but he's actually doing super well. He, like, just got married. It's incredible. He made this just, like, miraculous recovery, and he had incredible doctors and an incredible, like, rehab team. But it definitely made me think about life and death and just, like, what that all means. And it was the first time in my life where I had really confronted on impact, you know, not just like, oh, here I am going on in my life and, like, maybe I'm thinking about death now, but just, like, really confronted this idea of, like, whoa, what is going to happen if my brother dies? Or, like, what is, there's definitely, like, one specific song that came out of it that we recorded on the first Lula Wiles record, Don't Ask Why. But I think it will continue to affect me for my whole life, right? That experience, right? And, like, the ways in which that brought my family together, you know, brought us closer in some ways. And also, I think we would all say this, so I feel like it's okay for me to say this, you know, is that it also tore us apart in a lot of different ways. Like, there are these, like, sort of tears in the family that any family has, mm-hmm. obviously, like, the nuanced way that family is. And so I find myself being drawn to write about those kinds of things even now, like, years later, right? And I can't cite specific songs, but, like, there's one that I wrote and recorded, and it's, like, it's probably not even going to be released, whatever, but that it is about the moment when I was just sort of like, I don't know what's going to happen here, and, like, who do I even believe in? Like, I don't have someone I'm going to pray to. Like, I don't think this is, like, there was no destiny here. Like, I just think that happened, right? So I have another song about that, which is similar to what Don't Ask Why is about, but yeah, I sort of got rambling.
It sounds
like
that
was your question.
No, totally. Yeah. It sounds like the topic of, like, uncertainty is coming up for you quite a bit.
Specifically uncertainty with, like, I guess in referring to just Kyle's injury, my brother's injury, it's like, it makes sense. It's like, oh yes, this life event happened, and now you're thinking about uncertainty of life and death and mortality. But it's interesting that you were listening to all that and said, oh yeah, uncertainty, because that's another, I feel like I write so much about uncertainty, not about death, but about not understanding one's own feelings. And, like, I feel like I end up writing a lot about that, or, like, that is definitely what fuels my desire to write, is the desire to try to figure out what the heck I'm even feeling. And so for me, like, sitting down, trying to write a song about it really helps me, like, put into words and melody and music things that I feel that I didn't even really know I felt. So it's sort of like, I'll, like, chip away at all, like, the words and the ideas in my head. And then all of a sudden, like, I'll get to a point, I'm like, all right, like, this is what I'm feeling, you know? And often I'll get to that nugget or whatever, and I'm like, oh, right, this is what this song is about. So I have to, like, go back and, like, change the whole thing once I've, like, figured it out or whatever. But yeah, uncertainty is something that fascinates me, especially since I think it's kind of, like, discouraged to feel uncertain. And just kind of, you know, it's encouraged to be like, oh yeah, like, get your shit together and, like, have it together and make sure that definitely with, like, social media, it's like, well, it's going to look together, but also just have it together. Mm-hmm. There's all this, I think there's pressure to have that. And then,
I had another question of that, actually.
Definitely.
So, like, I felt weird about it because I'm like, I have a question about your brother's brain injury. Mm-hmm. And then I have a question about Chester Greenwood Day.
Oh my God. Okay.
But it actually ties in. So Chester Greenwood is the famous inventor of earmuffs, who's from Farmington, Maine.
Chester Greenwood was a great man.
And Chester Greenwood Day is something that's celebrated in Farmington December.
Oh yes.
And it seems, so it's like everybody wears earmuffs, somebody dresses up as Chester, and then they put earmuffs on the police cars and the fire trucks.
This year, it's so funny. I haven't been home for Chester Greenwood Day in a long time, but it's like, oh, it's just so classic Farmington.
Totally.
And I actually don't know, here, let's get specific. I don't know if he actually invented earmuffs, but he holds the patent for earmuffs, which is implied that he invented it unless he, like, killed the man.
Right, right.
Then now he owns the patent.
We'll have to check his Wikipedia
exactly.
page.
But here's will my, be fact-checked.
Here's my question that sort of ties into what you were talking about. So Chester Greenwood Day in Farmington, Maine, where they put giant earmuffs on the police cars to celebrate this guy who owns the patent for earmuffs. Yeah. It seems like a very small-town characteristic, which is, like, unique, but might be seen by outsiders as corny, you know, like so corny.
Yeah.
And it seems as though a lot of people in life are faced with this sort of like duality of like, I'm corny, I'm from a town where they put earmuffs on police cars, but also like, I'm very well put together and I'm very smart and well spoken and aren't I smart, you know, but like, you're like, I just want to like go back to my corny farm town and put my corduroys on.
Totally. Well, not so much corduroys, but I did buy a pair of overalls and I've just been loving wearing them in the big city.
So I just wonder if that, like, I don't know if that base of small town, like, corniness, like, helps you out in this kind of situation.
Interesting. That's such a good question. And I've never thought about it specifically or like in these terms, but
because don't you think that when you know you can present yourself like an image of yourself as this, you know, Instagram perfect type of person, but then when you reveal like the quirky vulnerability of like this is a part of me, people like it.
Well, yeah, I think that. Well, I have a few thoughts. One is that I think that I think during hard times, like especially emotionally hard times, I think that my only experience of this has been, you know, growing up in a small town, but there were really strong community connections there that like a lot of people would just show up to support each other, right? And so I know that when my brother got sick and was recovering, like that was a big part of what it meant to be in a small town was that like people were showing up and were bringing food and were helping my parents. And the other thought I had, unrelated to death, but yes, this idea of like sort of like mask or like picture that we paint of ourselves as, I'm specifically thinking as a professional musician, there's like a lot of, you know, there's Instagram, there's Facebook, there's the website, there are the promo shots. It's this whole thing. And then you make an album and you talk about the album and those things you're talking about are real, but in a lot of ways it gets sort of like, it gets curated. And I've found this to be true with Lula Wiles and with the music I make on my own, like not in that band, is that the songs that are like about the uncertainty, the songs that are like about your quirks or
about
like
being a mess.
The real, yes, like, I am a mess. Yeah. And the songs about like asking yourself, like, what the heck you're even doing. And that the response from listeners is really powerful to those songs or those moments, or even like explicitly sharing with people, whether it's, you know, I, for instance, with Don't Ask Why, I like to say, and I used to a lot more, like when I would introduce it on stage with Lula Wiles, I would say like, oh, this is a song that I wrote for my brother and my family when we went through a hard time. And then that sort of sets the stage for like, you know, then the listeners are, or the, you know, the audience member, they're listening through that lens. Mm. And like more often than not, somebody will come up to me and say like, oh yeah, that resonated with me because I felt similarly in a different situation. And when I don't say that on stage, it doesn't happen as often. And I think by like saying the thing and opening up to a whole bunch of people, it's really similar and really different to like me opening up to you as my friend. Like I told you about that just as a friend, but it like creates an intimate space for that kind of sharing to exist. And then when you do that on stage, when you like open that up, I think it's giving the audience permission to feel and to share with you.
It's kind of like what you're there for.
It's like the whole point.
Eleanor Buckley.
Yeah. But there are a couple of songs that, like, when I play, I think they do stand alone, you know, without saying anything about them. But if I do want to say something to, like, open up the window of vulnerability a little bit more, like, I will. And I think that can, like, enhance the emotional experience of listening to music if you're given the okay to feel deeply.
I think it is time for us to talk about Fiddle Camp.
Mm-hmm.
There
comes a time in every podcast where one must talk about Fiddle Camp, at least the folk podcast.
Right. Totally the folk podcast. So Lula Wiles is your band, and you met Molly.
Yes.
Technically, you met at a swimming lesson,
yes.
Which hopefully came in handy, and you guys know how to swim. Then you and Issa and Molly all went to Fiddle Camp together.
Yes.
Okay, so set the scene.
So it's called Maine Fiddle Camp, and it's in Montville, Maine. And this camp is incredible. It happens at this point 3 weeks out of the summer, and then there are 2 weekend camps. So they're like 5 sessions you could go to. And the purpose of the camp is, I think, to kind of preserve and celebrate the music culture in Maine, the folk music culture in Maine, and specifically like Maine fiddle tunes. So like these, folks from Maine or moved to Maine who are writing new fiddle tunes or like collecting old fiddle tunes. And so, but there's also like logging songs, right? Because Maine there's like a long, long tradition of loggers and like all these loggers boasts and these songs that have been collected. Oh yeah, it's very cool. And then also sea shanties, because Maine is an ocean coastal state. And so there are just so many great things about the Maine music history, right? And so that was kind of, I think, the like original point. But anyway, so set the scene. All of the classes take place outside under tents. So even when it's raining, you're like under like a small little yellow circus tent. And they're like striped. Though actually, big drama is that a few years ago, the Maine Fiddle Camp main tent changed from yellow and white stripes to blue and white stripes. And it's completely crazy.
Wow.
So there are just like gaggles of different age kids with fiddles and guitars and mandolins and accordions and like penny whistle and bass. Because Molly was learning bass. Issa and I were both learning fiddle. Issa and I, as my bandmate in Lula Wiles, we bonded in one of our first fiddle classes because we had the same favorite tune at the time, which was Hull's Reel. And I don't even think I could play you that tune anymore, but at the time I loved it. So yeah, imagine just like you love the fiddle and you're hanging out with a bunch of other like 13, 14, 15 year olds who also love the fiddle. And the fact that you are really into fiddle music is probably like kind of weird at your school, or I mean, not all your friends do it. And so just being at a camp where like all of your friends are also so stoked to learn.
All these like-minded,
people. And it's an all ages camp. That's something that's really special about it. So there are like babies there with their like young parents. And then also like 80 year olds who have been going for, you know, since it started and still like sawing away on the fiddle. It's an amazing place.
Did your other siblings go?
No. So I kind of, my siblings and I, we were all quite musically inclined as young kids, but I was really the only one who like grabbed hold of it and kept doing it really avidly, taking lessons and being in a bunch of music groups through high school and then like kept at it. And so my younger siblings were way too into sports to go to fiddle camp, and my older sister sort of like just did more singing, and so she didn't end up going to camp until a few years ago. I brought her as an adult, and she was learning cello, and it was awesome.
That's cool. Yeah. So there's this tradition in certain folk circles of teaching each other. It's funny to use the word tradition again, but like traditional songs.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me kind of like making somebody a playlist and being like,
oh,
this
man
is what I like. You know, so I just was wondering.
That's such a good analogy.
Yeah, can you talk about that act of like teaching your friends a traditional song? And then also, have you ever used that as like a way to try to like become friends with somebody or like really try to get to know somebody?
Whoa.
Like you would a mixtape?
These are, oh my gosh, these are great questions. Well, there's definitely something that can be super romantic about this idea of, like, getting really close together and, like, being like, oh, this is how you play this tune, and so here's this phrase, and you, like, play the phrase, and then the other person plays it back, and you have to, like, be kind of close. And it's that way, if it's, like, a one-on-one thing, yeah, it can be really intimate. And I don't think, I can't think of an example of a time where I did it in, like, a manipulative way of trying to get to know someone. But definitely it's a way to get really close to somebody. I can think specifically of Issa. We became really close because of that, exactly. You know, we bonded about Harry Potter, but we also, I remember her teaching me how to play this old-time tune called Old Yeller Dog Come Trotting Through the Meetin' House, which is an incredible title. and she taught it to me when we were like 13 or 14. It was a really cool way of becoming friends with somebody, because you're like, yeah, it's there's a closeness that comes with it. And it's definitely a really special thing that I've found in the folk community that I don't know if I've found other places, and I'm sure it exists. But the experience of, like, a bunch of people sitting down together to jam and trying to figure out, like, oh, what songs do we all already know? And kind of trying to discover, like, what are the little, like, nuggets of tunes where it's like, oh, two people know this tune or this song or this traditional song. Mm-hmm. And I think this is true with non-traditional music, too, like contemporary folk music or sort of, like, and classic country music, like Emmylou Harris and Graham Parsons.
Like, really campfire songs.
Yes, campfire songs, mm-hmm. where a bunch of people sit down together and it's, like, as long as two people know it, it's like, oh, yeah, let's play it. And then the other people are sort of, it's, like, this window into this, you know, there's a bond of, like, oh, we know this same tune and now all of you can learn this tune from us. Especially if the jam is small enough or, like, cohesive and really, like, open and welcoming enough. It's a super special thing.
So talking about the live music experience with Lula Wiles, I've never seen you play solo as far
Sydney,
as I know.
That's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
Other than at Miles of Music.
Yeah. Which is a music camp, which is much like fiddle camp, except there's all sorts of instruments there.
Yeah.
I want to know what the live music experience is like for you, because you seem like to, like, transport to, like, some place that seems really nice, you know, like a really good, like, what is that place like for you? What's that
when
experience
when I perform?
Like?
Yeah. No one has ever asked me this before. I feel really alive when I am singing and performing, and I think that it's generally a really good place, right? Like, you know, because yeah, singing and performing is, you know, like, up there top favorite things to do in life. And the way it feels to sing and the way it feels to especially perform, now that I write my own songs, perform songs, basically sort of be like, hey, this is something that I felt and I think is real and I think might matter because it matters to me and so maybe it matters to you. I think that the experience of performing when you, like, believe in what you're singing or you believe in the music or the connection that you have with the other people on stage, which is definitely the case in Lula Wiles. I think part of the reason that I love performing with Issa and Molly in that band is that we do have this really, really strong connection. And so, you know, after so many years of being friends, but also musically, it just, like, really works together when we're up there together. And so to be able to put that all, like, put it all out there and you're like, hey, I'm singing with, like, my best friends and, you know, we love each other and we're, like, proud of this music we're making and we think it matters and maybe you will too. It's, like, all of that rolled into the experience. And, oh, I feel like I'm having such a hard time articulating this because it feels more important than the words, these sort of, like, plain conversational words that I'm coming up with, but it's really powerful. And so I think that is probably what is shown, like, what if you've seen me perform, it's like, and what you're talking about, I think that's what's happening, is I just am, like, I'm definitely in a good place. You know, I definitely feel, like, really, for the most part, really happy when I'm performing. Yeah.
Except when you're not.
Except when I'm, like, in a dark place.
So I don't, I feel like I have so many questions for you, but I just want to mention that you went to Berkeley.
I did.
And
that
so
happened.
Did Issa. Mm-hmm. Did Molly go to Berkeley?
Molly went to Berkeley for 3 semesters, and then she left. But so we all three went to Berkeley for various lengths of time.
What was your focus there?
That is a great question. what was my focus? My focus originally was violin performance, and I quickly got so stressed by that. And I also fell in love with writing songs during my first year of college, first year at Berkeley. I hadn't been a songwriter, but I'd always been a singer, and singing had been such a like deep part of who, you know, my identity. And as soon as I met a few songwriters at the time, Laura Cortese, who's a good friend of mine, and at Miles of Music Camp, I met all of these incredible songwriters there, and they were just like people that I was meeting, and I sort of realized, oh my gosh, like all that I have to do to be a songwriter is to just like write a song. There's not like a big like, deal.
You have to fill out a form.
No, there's no form. There's no bureaucracy in songwriting. Yeah. And also I will give a shout out to Maya DeVitri, and she's definitely, it was instrumental in sort of like me feeling like I could be a songwriter, and our friendship during my first year of Berkeley. Anyway, so the point is I was deeply unhappy as a performance major in the violin department, and the string department is great. I love them, but it was not a good fit for me. And so I switched my major to songwriting, worked with some incredible songwriters, and then I dropped out. But that was my focus. My focus was violin, and then it was not violin.
Yeah.
And I have a complicated relationship with my violin, which is not a secret. And then my focus was songwriting, and continues to be my kind of main musical focus even now.
So Club Hasim is the folk venue in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It really gave Lula Wiles the opportunity to develop on stage.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, can you just explain briefly what happened at the club for your band? And then is there a way to like put into words why that artist development was so important to a band like Lula Wiles?
Oh man, it's such a good question. What ended up happening for us in the band was that, I mean, there are all these incredible opportunities at Club Hasim to perform as like a new band, specifically this like campfire festival that happens a couple times in the summer, like once at the beginning of the summer and then at the end of the summer, I think. And Issa and I were playing as a duo, and we played a campfire festival, and Matt Smith became just an incredible supporter, but an early champion of the band. And so as soon as we had Molly in the band, he started booking us before we even had a band name. And then when we had our like first dumb band name, and then finally when we were Lula Wiles, he just thought of us all the time to open for people coming through town. And so for like 6 to 8 months, we were opening shows like every other month. It was, I mean, maybe not exactly that, but just we had so many great opening gigs. Like, we opened for Mike and Ruthie, and we opened for Rose Cousins. There were other folks too, but those two stick out to me. And so Matt did a really great job of just helping us get in front of tons of different people, like all these other artist audiences. I think Matt Smith is part of like what the heart and soul of Club Hasim, you know, is, but the community at the club and then Matt himself, it's like, it was a way for us to connect not only with new audiences, you know, each of these opening gigs, but connect with the musicians themselves, right? And so, like, you know, after we opened for Rose, like, a couple years later, we did a bunch of opening shows for her on her album release tour, and then now we're playing Mike and Ruthie's festival in February, right? So there, I think, was that that was the first part of your question, right?
Yeah,
like how did that happen? But then why was it so important?
Yeah.
It's exactly that, because it's multiple folds of importance, right? Of this like, oh, you're exposed to so many audiences and then you meet all these musicians and those connections are so lasting, I think, especially in the folk music community. And I say especially, but it's really because that's like mostly just what I know. And I'm like, how could this? Yeah. And so I mean, I feel like I could talk forever about what it is like to be in a band with only women and the way that feels when, in the way that people talk to you, in the way that presenters are, in the way that promoters are, like the number of times that men say really, really uncomfortable things to you after a show, and the power dynamic is such that they're the audience member. They bought the ticket, and most likely they just bought your CD, and then they're like standing there and they're saying some like something that's just like gross or really out of touch, and it's like, do I react or do I just let it go or do I like, it's really hard and it feels really uncomfortable. You know, all girl band, like that's not a genre of music. That's just, it's like a fact, you know, we're like the three of us in a band, but, and you know, we all are women and identify as women. And so it's like, it's a part of it, but it can be really uncomfortable. And in the industry, and there are situations where, yeah, especially at festivals or like different situations where people are drinking, there becomes like a, yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely like on my guard. A lot, and I wonder, I don't know if that's the case for men when they're at the festival and it's late and people are drinking. Like, I don't know if they're on their guard.
Right, probably not.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
So I've noticed something that is true of you and Molly and Issa is that you do not participate in shaving.
Mm-hmm.
Is that...
Totally a question you can ask me.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know more about that. Like, what is the reason? Was it a collaborative decision?
It wasn't a collaborative decision, but it was something that I think we all just came to on our own, like on our own timelines. And like, I can only speak to my experience. And oh man, like the way I grew up, I think was pretty wonderful. Like I have this incredible relationship with my mom, and she's always had short hair and is just like never shaved ever. And was always like, she's a nurse and she's like really, was always really comfortable. At least I found it to be really comfortable talking with her about kind of anything. Like when I got my period for the first time, I was just like, cool, I can talk to you about this. But she never wore makeup and she never shaved and we didn't have television growing up in my family. And like the major reason, and my mom has like told us this, is that she just hated the way women were portrayed, or like the roles in which they like had to be in on television, and just kind of like the general media before there was like our phones and the internet and everything. She was like, I can control that there's like not going to be kind of just generic, like, you know, television. Yeah. But so as far as like shaving, I just sort of asked myself, like, why the heck am I doing this? And now it feels really, I just feel much more comfortable that way. And then like I shave my legs, yeah, and shave my armpits for my brother's wedding, you know, and it like felt fun. I was wearing this like really great, I loved the dress I was wearing. I was wearing these fun heels. And so it felt very much like a special occasion. But as soon as the wedding was over, like as soon as I went back to my life, it felt really strange to have shaved legs and like no hair under my arms. And I like that when we're on stage as Lula Wiles, and if it's a summer and we're wearing like a, you know, a sleeveless dress or something or whatever, like, and people can see that, I like that because I think that that should be normalized. Like that is okay. And there's one amazing story I just thought of, is that so at a fiddle camp that we teach at called Ossabee Valley String Camp. It's not the one we grew up going to, but Issa and I have been teaching there for a while, and Molly just started teaching. And we teach there. We have taught there in the past with Brittany Haas, and one of our students who was maybe like 12 or 13. Her mom told us a story, and she came up to me at one point. She was like, hey, I just want to let you know that, like, she's at that age where, like, she's going into middle school, and she's been, like, asking me about shaving and, like, all these different things. And this is in my voice. It's, like, the first time when you're, like, getting a bra or, like, what is happening with my period? Whatever, shaving. All my friends are doing it. Anyway, so this mother was, like, she was talking to me, and she's, like, you know, I don't think I want to shave under my arms because like Ellie and Issa and Molly and Brittany, they don't do it. And it's like, I wasn't like looking on stage and seeing, I don't know. I can't think of people I was seeing as a young person, as a musician, where like that was an okay way to do things, mm-hmm. right? And maybe it's like a drop in the bucket of the ocean, but that feels good to sort of be like, right, being a woman and like becoming a woman can look like a lot of different things.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be one thing. And it can also be this ongoing process of like exploration and discovery that like you're like, oh, I think I know what it means to be me and to be a woman. And then you learn more and you figure out you didn't know. And then you, I don't know, so you stop shaving or you start shaving again and like whatever the heck. But like, think about, I like the idea of like thinking about why you're doing it or why you're not doing it. Just being engaged in that part of it.
Sweet. Eleanor really. Buckland.
Thank you, Cindy.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Yeah, I was so honored to be on there.
Eleanor Buckland of the band Lula Wiles, the new album, which I feel like we barely talked about. I don't think we even talked about it at all in the interview, but it's really great. It's called What Will We Do? It's out now on Smithsonian Folkways Records. Thank you for listening to Basic Folk. Also want to say thanks to our sponsors. Okay, Basic Folk is supported by Lindsay Myers from LMNO Management, who suggests that if you like this podcast, you'd also like the band Tina and Her Pony. You can check them out on your preferred streaming platform or follow them at Tina and Her Pony on Facebook and Instagram. And thanks to WIUP in Indiana, Pennsylvania, which airs Basic Folk 2 p.m. Eastern every Saturday. You can listen on 90.1 if you're in the Indiana, PA area, or at their website, WIUP.org. Thanks to my producer, Laura McCarthy, who, hey, this is the first Basic Folk that Laura edited all like by herself. She did a fantastic job, and she's just the best. Thanks to Alex Stanton of the band Townspeople for our music on Basic Folk, and we'll see you next week. All right. Thanks. Bye.
Oh my God, this podcast is going to end with discussion of armpit hair. I love it.